Thank you. Be seated. The court is ready to hear oral argument petitioner in Crown Life versus Castile.
May it please the court, Mr. Gion Waldrop will present argument for the petitioner. Petitioner has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court. Of the number of very important issues that this case presents to the court, probably the most prominent and certainly the one that's potentially dispositive in and of itself is the standing issue under Article 2141 of the Insurance Code. The way that issue was presented to the court in this case is this, and that is, do agents of insurance companies have standing to sue the insurance company based on a deceptive act, alleged deceptive act or practice, in the process or the transaction of the sale of insurance policies? Now, the court is going to need to decide that case. It's a case of first impression in this court, but it's not a case of first impression in other courts. As a matter of fact, probably, certainly, five or six courts, including the Fifth Circuit, have addressed this question at least tangentially.
You can see that they do have the right to sue under Article 2121.
That's correct. We do concede that.
And so you're just limiting your argument to saying that in this fact scenario, they don't have the right to sue.
Not exactly that, Your Honor.
Let's take a couple of steps. One, you agree that under Garrison, we held that under Section 2 and Section 16, insurance agents could be sued.
That's correct.
And then you also agree that insurance agents do have the right to sue under Section 16. And so where do you put the brackets on the limitation of their ability to sue? What draws the line?
What draws the line for all cases is the hard question. I would answer it in two parts. Number one, in this case, the court is asked to draw a very specific line and say, are agents in or out of the group of people that can sue for the kinds of allegations in this case? I think that's an easier question. I think the answer to that question is no, and the court can rule that way under the facts of this case and for the provisions at issue in this case. The second part is the broader question, and that is, okay, where do you draw the line? And certainly this court is going to want to give consideration to that when it decides this case, because this case will be the first step in fashioning that rule. And so you do have to ask the question, and I think it's very important to ask the question, where do we draw the line? As the Fifth Circuit pointed out in the Warfield case, 2121 and the way that it is structured with the definition of person being so broad and the definition of the acts that are the subject of litigation cannot mean literally what it says. It can't mean that every conceivable person gets to sue under every one of those sections.
So you agree with what the Warfield case says?
Absolutely.
Let me read to you from the Warfield case. It talks about Chapin and Herman stand for the proposition that absent privity of contract or some sort of reliance by the person bringing the claim on the words or deeds of the insurer, a suit will not lie under Article 2121. Applying that phrase, we have in this situation Mr. Castile relying upon the words and deeds of the insurer. And so it falls perfectly within the framework of what Warfield said.
I don't think it does, Your Honor, and here's why. What the court in Warfield was saying in the Herman Hospital is it was saying, first of all, we look at the first cases that looked at this problem, and they said only insureds or beneficiaries. Then it said, but their Herman Hospital came in and expanded that rule somewhat, and it expanded it for people who did rely, but not everyone. It expanded it for certain kinds of people who relied. Now, I don't think that what Warfield was saying was that if you relied on the representation, you have a cause of action. What Warfield was saying is we have to explain Herman Hospital. We have to explain in the context of this problem why Herman Hospital gets standing when Herman Hospital doesn't have a contractual relationship with the insurance company. And that was its explanation. It goes on to say,
wasn't there a contract between Castile and Crown Life?
Yes, there was a contract between, it was an agency agreement.
And in order for Castile to perform his agent functions, he had to rely upon the information provided him by Crown Life.
I think that that is not a good way of phrasing that. What the agent has to do in the traditional principle of agent relationship is perform the duties prescribed by the principal. Agent, please do these things for me, and here are the things I want you to do.
But he wasn't creating the information that he passed on to the people he was trying to sell the policies to. He was passing along the information given to him by Crown Life, and he had to rely upon the veracity and accuracy.
Actually, no, Your Honor. I wouldn't say it that way. He was passing it on, and that's exactly our point. He was like the hand of the company or the mouthpiece of the company. He was a conduit. He was passing that information on. He was not the entity or the person in the transaction who was relying on it.
Well,
that
was
the consumer.
But he relied in a different way. He was an agent for other companies. He had other business.
That's correct.
So that if his credibility is impaired in one respect, it might be impaired as to his whole business.
That is always the case. And that's one of the things that they trumpet in this case, and they say, well, look, agents in this type of situation, particularly independent brokers like Mr. Castile, are sizing up this information, and if it's wrong or if it affects their reputation, then that's some sort of damage. Our response to that is no different than the kind of damage that the Fifth Circuit articulated in Warfield. It's collateral. The person that these representations, or the entity that these representations are targeted to in an insurance transaction is the consumer, not the agent. That ground zero is the consumer. There is going to always, in any type of tort action, going to be collateral damage based on a causation theory.
You agree an agent can be sued for misinformation the agent gives to a potential insurer.
That's correct. We can see that.
Can be sued for multiple damages.
Can be sued.
And can get indemnity from the insurer.
That's exactly right. There are two ways that the agent is protected. I guess that the essence of that point is, well, are we structuring some kind of structure where the agent can get sued but can't sue? And the answer to that is this. When the agent is acting in his capacity as a mouthpiece or a conduit agent, truly the agent of the insurance company, he is the insurance company in that transaction.
Well, but this is a soliciting agent, kind of the agent, kind of not the agent, isn't he?
No.
He's kind of the agent for the company, but he's kind of the agent for the insurer, not?
No, absolutely not. On that point, I think that the Texas law is unequivocal. Texas law says, in fact, the statute specifically says for just this reason, that when you look at this transaction, the agent is the agent of the company. We're not going to have any more of this equivocation. I may be the agent for one or both or kind of in the middle, kind of like the problem we've got with the real estate business. It is not like that. Texas law is unequivocal. The agent is the agent of the company, and that's statutory, and that's very clear. And there's good reason for that. It's because the agent is the conduit for information from the company to the consuming public.
So any misrepresentation Mr. Castile made that was based on information he got from Crown Life, you indemnify 100% any damages he might suffer. Is that right?
Not exactly, but it's close. There are two ways that the agent is protected when he's the subject of suit. One is potential contractual indemnity. If he signs up for it up front, it is whatever the contract dictates that it is. And that will be dictated by the contract. The second and probably the most important, and the one that I believe you're referring to, is the potential for common law indemnity. And it's there. It is still around where the agent is purely vicariously liable. If he's innocent, then there will be indemnity.
Did Mr. Castile sue for that?
He did not.
In this case,
the facts in this case are that you apparently bought out the plaintiff's cause of action and sued and brought and prosecuted suit against Castile yourself.
No, Your Honor. In fact, that's one of the great, I hate to use the word misrepresentation, but it's gotten muddled in the briefing in this case. And that is, what happened at the trial court level is that after the verdict and before judgment was entered, the company settled with the policyholder. And as part of that settlement, the company took an assignment of the policyholder's claims against Mr. Castile, and the court went ahead and rendered judgment in favor of the policyholder against Mr. Castile based on the verdict. Crown Life took an assignment of that judgment. Now, what is not clear from this record is why that occurred. It doesn't need to be clear on this record because The issue of whether that assignment is either good or bad or what the ramifications of it are for another case in another day.
Well, let's put it this way. Are you saying that regardless of how this case turns out, you and your client are not going to ask a penny from Mr. Castillo?
No, we're not saying that. I will say this, and I'll say it for the purposes of
what
the
you're
record.
Saying is that if you are going to win, you are going to be asking for money from Mr. Castillo.
No. In fact, I'll tell you exactly what our position is. Even though it's not of record, I'll make it of record right now. Our position is this. If we lose this case, then we will attempt to use that judgment as an offset to whatever our liability is. If we win this case, there will be no attempt to collect on that judgment. The reason that that judgment exists is not a product of Crown Life in this case. That's not a record, but it's true. And it would be, in the time that the issue of whether that assignment comes up and the evidentiary process involved with that, it would come out. The plaintiff insisted on a judgment be taken for plaintiff's own reasons. Crown Life had to protect itself because it could not have a judgment against its agent floating out there that anyone could come by and possibly prosecute against Crown. And so Crown was in no position, was forced, because of the plaintiff's position on settlement, to take an assignment. Now, we haven't attempted to collect it. We haven't done anything with it because we're waiting to see how this case comes out. If this case comes out and we lose, then we will do what we can within the court system to get credit for that amount of that judgment and see how that comes out in later litigation. But what we're not doing, and what we have never tried to do, is proactively come in and get a judgment against Mr. Castillo. And I'm not suggesting that Crown could sue Mr. Castillo in this situation.
All right, let me redirect your attention back to Article 2121. It's agreed that Mr. Castillo is a person for purposes of Article 2121.
No, Your Honor. He is a person for certain purposes of Article 2121 and certain provisions and certain things that the statute does, and he is not a person for other purposes of Article 2121. There really are two different categories, and you have to put him in one or the other.
Okay. And what statutory language do you rely upon to say that Mr. Castillo is not a person for purposes of bringing this particular case?
The statutory language we rely on is not direct, because if you do what the Court of Appeals did and you do a mechanical application of this person, he is defined in the definition of person, Section 16, persons get to sue. If that's all that the court does, then and take that mechanical approach, then we lose this case. What we believe should be done, though, is that you have to look at Section 4 and look at all the provisions. What you see in Section 4 is the acts or practices that are subject to being a cause of action pursuant to Section 16 are numerous and they're varied. You have some that are based on misrepresentation. You have others that have to do with defamation. You have some that have to do with boycott. So what we would say is what the Fifth Circuit has said and every other court that's looked at this, and frankly this court in Watson, is that when you look at this structure, you cannot come to the conclusion that every conceivable person can bring a claim under each one of these subdivisions of four.
And looking at the structure, some of the claims brought by Mr. Castillo fall within Section 4, Subsection 1.
That's correct.
And if you look at the last, do you have...
We would say all of them do, but...
Okay, do you have Section 4, Subsection 1 in front of you?
I do.
If you look at the last three lines, after that comma phrase, twice it makes a reference to policyholders. The entirety of that section before that, with regard to the other misrepresentations, it doesn't make any reference to policyholders. Why should we not consider that in thinking, well, the legislature was clear that they could put policyholder in there when they wanted to, and they did not include it for purposeful reasons?
Because the preceding clause to that refers to making misrepresentations or misleading representations as to the financial condition of any insurer or the legal reserve system from which the licensure operates.
But look at the very top, which concerns this, making, issuing, circulating, and causing to be made, issued, circulated statements misrepresenting the terms of any policy. That part relates to this particular case, but that part doesn't have the policyholder language in there that later on in that particular rule it does have.
That's correct. It doesn't. And I'm not suggesting that this statute is model clarity. It is not a model of clarity. In fact, our position is such in this case that we're saying the court needs to come in and make sense of this statute and how it works. What I would say about how to interpret that is this first part applies to whomever it applies to. Who's targeted? Who is it targeted to? And when you ask that question, you can see that I see that my time is up.
I have a question before you sit down. Setting aside Article 2121, and assuming as we must that all of the allegations in this case are true and that the damages suffered were compensable, what causes of action does Mr. Castile have against Crown that are viable?
None in this case.
No?
If he had had a contract that included some protection for this, he might have had that, but in this case he doesn't. And so my direct response to you is, in the context of this case and under these facts and under these allegations, he does not have a cause of action against Crown Life under these facts and his allegations in this case, period.
They're not consequential damages for breach of contract?
They could be if there was a breach. In fact, that's exactly our position, is that these kinds of damages that he is seeking, if they're anything, they are consequential damages for breach of contract. His problem is he doesn't have a breach of contract to point to trigger damages. But that's part of our point in this case. If he's going to have any remedy, that remedy needs to be built into the contract. And these
when your principal misrepresents facts to you on which you rely and in turn selling a private principal, why isn't that a breach of the contract between the principal and the agent?
Well, it would be a breach of the contract if the contract said, you promised to supply me only with accurate information. If there's no promise of that effect, then there can't be any breach of that promise.
So the principal can just lie to the agent and then no consequences from that?
No, absolutely not. What we're saying in this case and in the context of this kind of case is that the kinds of misrepresentations that are alleged to be actionable here are representations made not to the agent but made to the consumer.
But
the
agent was using them to make a profit. He was using them to make commissions.
That's absolutely right. He was doing that. And but that bolsters my point, is that those representations are made to the consumer. These representations in the context of this kind of transaction are representations from the company through the agent to the consumer. They are not representations from the company to the agent and then from the agent to the consumer.
How is this agent supposed to maintain credibility in the marketplace as an independent agent? Will he just say later, well, of course the stuff I told you about my Crown Life policies wasn't true, but you can trust me when I'm selling you Prudential?
He has one of two ways to do that. Number one, he can be careful for what he vouches for. Actually, it has three ways. Number two, he can investigate it for himself to the extent that's possible.
Are either one of those practical in these circumstances?
Oh, I think they're very practical. And the third way is by contract. And I think that that's the one that's not very practical in most situations because I don't think the market's going to allow much of that. But the first two really are practical. And they're true. That's why you don't see this kind of case. We haven't seen one until now. It took a special case for this to happen. Most life insurance agents are going to be very knowledgeable about the kinds of things that they're showing.
So if the agent just isn't smart enough to figure out that he's being lied to, then that's just his problem and he has to accept the consequences.
Well, yes and no. No, he doesn't have to just accept the consequences of it. But
why doesn't he have a tort action?
Well, he doesn't have a tort action because he is part of the company and the company's arm and mouthpiece for this kind of transaction. To the extent that he suffers what I would call collateral damage, like the restaurant or the grocery store examples in Warfield, then we're not going to give him any protection for those for the very same reasons that we don't give the restaurant or the grocery store or the dry cleaners protection when they suffer collateral damage when this type of problem
Why
occurs.
Why is this a pure common law fraud cause of action? Misrepresentations were made to him on which he relied, and he suffered damages as a direct consequence. Why isn't this just a pure fraud case?
Two reasons. Number one, and probably the most critical one to this case, is that since that happened through the process of summary judgment, he ratified or waived his fraud claims in this case, and that issue was not controverted in the trial court, and that the Court of Appeals found that, and I think quite rightly found that. So we have a ratification and waiver problem in this case.
So that means he does have a cause of action for fraud. He just couldn't pursue it in this case.
No. The second part of my answer, and the second reason why he can cannot do that, is that it's our position that there is no set of circumstances that would allow an agent to sue for fraud in this type of circumstance, and we don't want that. If the court were to adopt that type of an approach and say that agents could sue their principals in this type of context, where the agent is being the conduit or mouthpiece for a transaction that's essentially between the company and the consumer, if we adopt that, then what we are saying, we're fundamentally changing the nature of the principal-agent relationship.
Why is that? If the agent is truly innocent and the principal makes fraudulent misrepresentations which are passed along to a consumer, a purchaser, and the agent loses his business as a result, why shouldn't the principal be liable for the fraudulent misrepresentation?
The first part, two reasons. Number one, the representation is not really being made to the agent. The representation is being made to the consumer.
It's being made to the agent, knowing that the agent will pass it along for the purpose of making a sale. It is made to the agent.
Well, it's hoping that the agent will pass it along
with
correctly.
With the intent.
With the intent that the agent pass it along. But the representation is not going from the company to the agent. The nature of the transaction is the representation is really going from the company to the consumer. And what we want to do, and I think what we ought to do as a rule, is view the agent and the principal in this kind of situation as a unit.
So you accept the notion that whatever the agent is liable for, if it is as a result of a misrepresentation by the principal, that the agent be permitted, just as a matter of law, to pass through all the liability, including the additional damages and DTPA extra damages, right to the principal, and the principal agrees to pick up the tab?
No. We will hear from
that. Okay.
Here's what we do say. If he's truly innocent, then he does get to pass through the liability to the consumer.
Including the additional damages under 2121 and extra damages under DTPA.
If they are the consumer's damage. If there's something that he's liable for to the consumer and he's truly innocent.
Right.
The problem arises when you say, all right, does he get to pass through his own collateral damage, the damage to his reputation, which is really an issue in this case? That's where the problem arises. And the answer, I believe, and the answer should be no. And you see, I think the court could rightfully say, then where's his remedy for that? And the answer is twofold. Number one, if it's not in the contract, he doesn't have a remedy for that. And the reason for that is the same reason as the reasons that we have for cutting off liability at any point to the restaurant owner, to anybody else that's remotely caused damage from this type of event. We draw a line as a society and as a
okay, but didn't you concede earlier that practically speaking, he's not going to get a contract like that? What life insurance company is going to give that kind of contract to someone who's going to be selling for him? They're going to give the contract to them that they want him to have. And if he won't take it, they'll find someone else to sell the policies.
That's absolutely right. That's how the market system works. And I'm going to
so what that means is that the contract remedy is not a viable remedy.
I don't want to concede that it's not viable completely. I would concede the point that probably in today's market it's unlikely that this kind of contract is going to be negotiated by an agent. But what I would say to the court and say to you is that that's okay. There's no great evil in that. That when life insurance agents go in to sign up to sell life insurance with their company, they know on the front end, if they don't get a built-in indemnity or some built-in promise to pay for loss to damage to their reputation, if it turns out that some piece of information they get from their company and pass on harms them, they understand that on the front end. And that's why I said earlier that this case is unique. Life insurance agents know that. They are knowledgeable about these processes. Remember, this case involves, at its core and at its essence, the handing of illustrations that illustrate how a policy works to an agent who then passes them on to the consuming public. Agents understand and have the ability to understand how these illustrations essentially work. They always do. That's why this case has to be special to come up the way it does. You have to have a guy like Mr. Castile who is willing to completely change his testimony and say, oh, well, I really didn't understand it, in order to try to create this kind of litigation. That's not going to happen very often, and there is no problem, I would suggest, from a societal perspective, having agents know, if in working for my principal's bad reputation rubs off on me, That's just a market risk that I take, and I don't have a cause of action back against my principal because from the market perspective, from the transactions perspective, I am my principal in that case, and I willingly sign up for this. That falls right into the Delaney rationale, and that is I go in and I willingly sign up to be a unit with my principal, and if I don't build into that contract a duty to protect my reputation, then I don't have it.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
The court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
May it please the court, Ms. Cindy Olson Berlin will present argument for respondent.
May it please the court. I'm Cindy Borland, and along with Kent Hans, I represent the respondent and cross-petitioner in this case, William Castile. Yes, this case is unique. In this case, Crown Life, a Canadian insurance company, seeks to use the Texas Insurance Code as both a sword and a shield against Castile. It seeks to use the code as a shield, arguing that Castile has no standing to sue under the code for Crown's deceptive acts. But it uses the code as a sword in that it has strategically taken an assignment of the trial plaintiff's judgment, as this court noted. Now, I suppose that it should be some relief to my client 3 years later that he's been having a judgment hanging over his head that Crown can enforce, but today in open court, Mr. Waldrop announces that they do not intend to collect. That's improper. It's outside the record. There's nothing on the record to that effect. And in fact, I want... It is not accurate that there has been no attempts to collect this judgment. But regardless, the issue before the court today is, can this distortion of justice stand? Crown's judgment...
Excuse me, let's step away from the facts of this particular case and look at the broader picture. Let's suppose that there was a judgment against the insurance company and the agent, and it was trebled under the DTPA. The insurance agent gets indemnity, presumably, for his portion, his liability from the principal. But then can he also turn around in a 21-21 and get the judgment, the treble judgment he paid, then ask for it against the agent, the insurance company, and get that judgment treble?
No, Your Honor. Because the indemnity, as Mr. Waldrop pointed out, is covered by the contract in this case. However, this goes not to the injury that the policyholder is seeking back against the two defendants, the insurance company.
Why wouldn't it apply in that situation? You're an agent. You have a judgment against you for in favor of the policyholder, and you have to pay it, and you have to pay treble damages because it's also a DTPA violation. Then you turn around and sue your agent to recover the money, the treble damages you had to pay to the insured, and then you ask, because those were your damages, to have them trebled once again as against the insurance company. Why isn't that the way it works under 21-21?
Well, Your Honor, there's not a case on that. It may be that that would be a cause of action that would stand. However, there's a direct claim that Castile has under the plain wording of Article 21-21 in that he can sue directly his principal for deceptive act. The deceptive acts at question here are those at the point from Crown to Castile. That's the cause of action, not as to what was passed on.
No, but the damages are, the consequences of that are, of those misrepresentations, is that the agent is now liable to the insured. And let's assume we're not talking about the kinds of damages that were covered here, but we're talking about the damages that the agent had to pay as a result of misrepresentations that were passed along. Why can't those damages be trebled and trebled again if we recognize the kind of cause of action that you're advocating?
Your Honor, perhaps they can. Perhaps they can. There's not a case on that. That would be an open issue for this court. And perhaps it could. In this case, we're simply arguing that Castile, because he has a direct action under 21.21, does not have to take that extra step. Furthermore, his rights of contribution are in a sense at issue in this case with the assignment. One of the issues presented is whether or not the Court of Appeals properly applied a dollar-for-dollar credit against the amount with which Crown settled with the trial plaintiffs. We argue that the Court of Appeals was correct in that regard. But going back to Justice Owen's question, the issue of whether he is a person would still be implicated in the scenario you discussed, Justice Owen, because as Crown has argued, they don't believe he is a person as a plaintiff in any situation.
Do you agree there are some situations in which he's not?
No, Your Honor.
He's a person for every purpose under the Act.
Your Honor, yes, in the sense that this case is not about every conceivable person. This case is about Bill Castile, an insurance agent.
Well,
and in
I'm
fact, specifically...
About, they say the person has to be limited under the statute. Do you agree with that or not?
I agree with that, Your Honor, in the third-party and unfair settlement practices cases.
But with respect to agent, shouldn't it be limited? Can an agent complain about the insured's treatment of him as an agent, or employment practices, delayed compensation, or any of those things?
No, Your Honor, if it falls under Section 4, he can. If it's delineated in the code, he can. Otherwise, he cannot. And the terms of the code, luckily, finish this analysis for us.
So you agree with the petitioner that we should look to Section 4 to try to understand who is a person for what purposes under the statute?
No, Your Honor, I don't agree. I agree that we should look, I would argue that we should look to Section 2A, which is the definition of person.
Well, that person, and there's no limit. I thought you said there wasn't.
Well, Your Honor, because that contains the word agent and broker, and that's clearly the position we have in this case with Castile, there's no need for this court, thankfully, to address this definition of person. That body of case law, starting with the Court of Appeals trilogy, Chafin, Sheffy, and Shelton, on down with Watson and Faircloth, those are all third-party claimant cases arising in an unfair settlement practice context. And the court has struggled with whether or not that comes under the insurance code or the BTPA. This court does not have to go there today. It does not need to reach that issue because the plain language, the plain definition so squarely reaches agents and brokers, which Castile undisputedly is.
But you agree under the plain language that an insurance agent, whether it be Castile or anybody else, the scope of the action that they could bring against an insurance company would be limited by the terms of Section 4.
Yes, Your Honor, and the joint authority of Section 1746 of the DCPA, as
if
is allowed by the code.
Consumer.
Yes. Yes, Your Honor, and I think the code solves that problem by its terms. We're not arguing for an extension of a cause of action beyond what is enumerated because, in fact, Crown's deceptive acts met squarely what is prohibited by the code. Now, it's interesting...
Well, what kind of... I take it you don't disagree with the court's analysis in Watson?
No, Your Honor.
With that being one end of the spectrum, and your case being the other end, where do we start putting some lines on when insurance agents can bring action?
Point being this. An insurance agent cannot bring a third-party claim action against an insurance company. You concede that?
Yes, Your Honor.
What type of relationship is necessary in order for either an insurance agent or any other kind of person to exist in order for them to be able to bring a cause of action as a person under Section 16?
Your Honor, the relationship articulated in Yorkville, a close relationship where one party, the agent, is bound to rely exclusively on the information provided by the principal. Justice Enoch, in his opinion on rehearing in Watson, was concerned that to establish duties for that insurance company as to a third-party claimant would set up these conflicting duties as to the insured and as to the third-party claimant. There's no such policy concerns present in this case because Castile and the consumer are aligned. They both want to receive the truth, true information about the policy they are selling or buying.
Did Castile have a contractual indemnity provision?
No, Your Honor.
Why not?
The contract between Castile and Crown is a little bit unusual in that it is on a form. It's Castile's form, and you'll find it in the record, Defendant's Exhibit 81. It's Castile's form, but the two parties to the contract are technically James Hicks, the general agent, and Castile. And within the terms of that, that was what was negotiated, and that's in the record. So that's what establishes the fact on that case.
Do you agree with Mr. Waldrop that Mr. Castile has common law indemnity rights against Crown Law?
Your Honor, he might. I don't totally agree with that. case law on, there's a void of case law on this, so I am unsure in this context where you're claiming from Article 2121.
No, I'm just common law for the for any damages that he would have to pay to the insurer.
Yes, Your Honor, then I believe he would under the common law.
Can an agent sue an insurer saying your product wasn't good enough and therefore I didn't make enough money and I want trouble damages?
Only if that cause of action would arise under the terms of either Section 4 or the Joint Authority Incorporation of 1746.
Does
and
it?
Because it does not, Your Honor. It does not. What's interesting in this case is that Crown argues in its brief that another reason Castile does not have standing under the code is that principles of agency merge the identity of Castile and Crown. Well, if principles of agency merge the identity of Castile and Crown, then Crown seeks to collect a judgment against itself. Furthermore, when this case was submitted to the jury, Crown certainly didn't object to having a proportionate liability question submitted where a percentage of liability could be assigned to Castile. In this case, you'll find on the record that the jury found on the as to the Fergusons, the trial plaintiff's damages, liability damages under the insurance code, Castile was 1% liable. Crown was 99% liable. Castile did not act knowingly, and Crown did.
Why didn't you answer common law identity?
Your Honor, because the cause of action at the trial court level was so clearly under the insurance code,
well,
and we
got alternate rulings to the extent that the insurer got a judgment against Mr. Castile, why didn't he ask for that to be indemnified, at least that part of his damages from Crown Life?
Well, Your Honor, that was a decision that was made at that time, and I'm not sure. We handled the case at the third court of appeals level and on up, and I'm not sure
that. If that had happened, we wouldn't have this $1.3 million judgment lurking out there, presumably, because Crown Life would have indemnified Mr. Castile.
Well, the indemnity damages would be different from the damages which he is seeking to recover
for now. Right, I'm just talking about his liability to the insurer. That would be out of the picture had you asked for common law indemnity.
Your Honor, that's not clear. I respectfully disagree. I don't know that that would be the case. However, his common law claims, as was pointed out, were dismissed by summary judgment. That's a point of error an issue presented by Castile, that this was improperly dismissed on summary judgment. Crown challenged this on summary judgment as being a no-duty summary judgment, that was the element they tried to dispose of summarily. The trial court erroneously granted that. But when you look in the record, you'll see as an appendix to our reply brief at Castile's affidavit, not only does it prove duty in this close relationship that I discussed with Justice Abbott, but it shows the elements of fraud. So that was an error by the trial court. And in fact, although we ask that you affirm the judgment of the third court on standing, in the unlikely event this court does not agree with that, then we would ask that you reinstate this common law cause of action.
Do you think you could be fully compensated with a common law fraud cause of action for all of the consequential damages?
No, Your Honor, I do not.
Why not?
Well, because under the fraud damage model, it's out-of-pocket expenses or other expenses caused by the fraud of the defendant. In this case, Your Honor, I want to rethink that. I believe he could conceivably be fully compensated by a fraud finding, assuming that his damages would be shown as they were at trial.
Is your fraud claim waived by the fact that you or Mr. Castile continued receiving commissions in this case?
Absolutely not, Your Honor. Ratification is an affirmative defense that was Crowns to prove its summary judgment. It did not do so, which is another error by the trial court. To prove ratification, Crown would have had to prove that Castile knew of the fraud and made an intentional act, showed a clear intention to accept the fraud, therefore waiving any right to complain about it. That is completely lacking in the summary judgment evidence. Furthermore, and it, of course for purposes of summary judgment, you don't know what's happened at trial, but it became clear at trial that Castile didn't even know the full scale of the misrepresentations until trial. So it's a bit odd, and it's certainly patently unfair for Crown to try to withhold information from him, but then claim he knew of the fraud.
Would it make any difference if the agent had one principal?
wasn't solely for one insurer?
It might, Your Honor. It would be a closer case. This court, recent opinion in April, Liberty Mutual versus Garrison, this court found that an employee who was also an agent, and an employee of an insurance company, was, of course, a party that had standing under the code. That was a much closer case than in this case, where Castile obviously brokers for several companies. But I believe under the pure language of the Article 2121, it wouldn't matter. He would still have standing. Now, it's interesting that the argument put forth by Crown mentions that Castile changed his testimony somehow in this case. That is completely contrary to the evidence, and I must respond to it. Crown's own witnesses testified unanimously on page 792, 1059, 3235, and 3257 of the record that Castile was never informed about any of the problems with these policies. The company's own internal memorandum described these things as time bombs, and this memorandum predated the point at which Castile sold the policies to the Fergusons and his other clients that ultimately resulted in this plethora of claims. So this was an avoidable problem. The evidence on this is undisputed. Crown acted in a deceptive manner, and that should not be allowed to stand. Turning briefly to Castile's mental anguish damages, the Court of Appeals got it right on standing, but they didn't get it right on Castile's mental anguish damages. The Court of Appeals found that the mental anguish damages in this record were legally insufficient. Your Honors, the standard of review here is well known to this court. This court must disregard all evidence contrary to the verdict and find that it's legally sufficient if more than a scintilla supports it. Well, in this case, which we summarize the evidence for you on pages 17 through 20 of our brief on the merits, Castile's brief on the merits, you can see the volume of mental anguish damages in this case. This court's recent opinion late
supported a verdict of $60 million.
Of $6 million, Your Honor?
60.
Your Honor, that would be a closer case. The guidelines that the jury had in this case concerned the scope of the transaction in question, what Castile made in selling the policy, and he testified emotionally that nothing he has been through has been worth $10,000.
I understood your argument in your brief, though, to be once the jury decides it, we just can't go behind it. So I'm wondering if $60 million would be, if we had this evidence, as you have portrayed it, would that support $60 million in mental anguish?
Your Honor, that would be a much closer call. I don't know that it would, because that is obviously a vast amount. In this case, of course, you know that the court awarded $6 million in past mental anguish.
If the jury had only found $60, you might complain that the evidence was supported a much larger number.
I might, Your Honor. But the key is, this court has recognized, in fact, Chief Justice Phillips recognized in City of Tyler versus Life, this tension in mental anguish law, that the law has not yet discovered an empirical inquiry for what is by definition a subjective inquiry. So juries must be given some discretion.
Did
but
you
no,
argue that the jury should use the mental anguish blank to penalize Crown Life?
Excuse me, Your Honor?
Was there an argument that the jury should take advantage of the opportunity to answer mental anguish damages to punish Crown Life?
Not in that word, Your Honor. It was argued by Castile's trial counsel in closing that based on the evidence, there was a mention of the size of Crown. However, that issue has not been preserved for this court. That was not raised in the petition for review by Crown as somehow harmful or properly caused the rendition of an improper verdict, nor was it objected to for that matter at trial. They have raised it, thrown it in there in their brief, but they didn't object to it nor ask for a limiting instruction, so it's of no merit at this point.
Okay. But it doesn't have anything to do with mental anguish.
No, Your Honor. And if Crown disagreed with the manner in which the case was argued, it should have objected.
Back on 2121, one last question. Do you agree with Warfield?
Yes, Your Honor, in the sense that it's limited to a third-party claimant case.
Everybody agrees with Warfield, so we should just adopt Warfield.
Well, now, it is a third-party claimant case in that it limits the person who has standing as a plaintiff under those facts. We argue that that's distinct from this case, but what I do agree with in Warfield is this description of the close relationship and why that's important. We know from the record on pages 1420 through 22, 1631 through 33, and 3272 that Catskill had no access to the proprietary software that created these, the projections and the information related to the vanishing premium policies. None whatsoever. Crown even filed a motion for protective order at trial so this trade secret information could not be disclosed. That's why the reasoning of that case is important in this case, but it does not, by any stretch of the imagination, prevent standing. Your Honors, for these reasons, we respectfully ask that this court affirm the Court of Appeals on standing, interest, and settlement credit, reverse on the issue of mental anguish, damages, and attorney's fees, and render judgment in accordance with the verdict. This
Any
court.
Other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
May it please the court, the plain language rationale just simply proves too much. The court acknowledged that in Watson. It acknowledged it in, to a certain extent, in Faircloth. It has acknowledged it in Garrison Contractors. That is not, it is not a viable mechanism for deciding this issue. And it ties right into some of the questions that were asked by the panel earlier about the remedy, the common law remedy, how that relates here. Some of the same concepts and rationales apply to the statutory problem, and that is this statute is really not intended in, under these circumstances to protect the agent for these types of problems. If you extend it to do that, well then what you will essentially be doing is you will be telling insurance companies, look, any person, regardless of who that person is, be it your agent or I'll say your employee, who later comes back and says, you didn't tell me something about the inner workings of your company or about the inner workings of your product that I, had I known, I wouldn't have done something that I did in reliance on it. Any one of those persons can sue the insurance company under this statute.
You know, you talked about the intent of the statute, and you referenced it also in your briefs. But looking at the intent of the statute, which is specific in Section 1, the purpose of it is to regulate trade practices in the business of insurance and to prevent conduct like this from happening. And it's intended to ensure viable claims can be asserted so that conduct like this does not happen.
It, to whom is the question that I would ask, and I would say there are two parts, and I think that we've tried to separate this. If you look at this Section 1, you will see that the purpose is to regulate trade practices which, one, constitute unfair methods of competition, or, two, unfair deceptive acts or practices. I think that's an important order, and I think it's reflected in the rest of the statute. There are really two purposes of this statute, which reflects the breadth of the definition of person. One, the statute is intended to give people in the insurance industry some protection from each other, to protect against unfair methods of competition. But it's, and to that extent, then agents and people in the business need to be persons.
Can I ask you about other parts of Section 4?
Certainly.
In other parts of Section 4, under unfair settlement practices, which is subsection 10, the legislature specifically made reference to an insured or a beneficiary. Under subsection 8 concerning rebates, at least three times, if not more, it uses the word policyholder. Under other provisions, it may make reference to other policyholders. If the legislature was clear in some of the language under various parts of Section 4 as to when they really intended for provision to pertain to policyholders, insureds or beneficiaries, why should we not presume that the legislature knew what it was doing when it did not make reference to those terms?
The reason that we shouldn't presume it is because we know it happens and we don't presume that in every other instance when it does. I can't tell you...
Don't we have an abundance of wealth of Texas jurisprudence saying just that?
Actually, we have an abundance and wealth of Texas jurisprudence that really says both things. When it makes sense to presume that the legislature knew what it was doing, then we do. When it doesn't make sense to presume that the legislature knew what it was doing, then we don't. And really, I think that the rule doesn't prove much for this kind of case, because you still have to ask the question, does the interpretation of the statute that we're going to adopt, the rule that we're going to adopt for this statute, make good sense given its whole structure? And I think that Section 10 provides an excellent example of what I'm talking about. The legislature came back and amended Section 10 after Watson, and it did so with Watson in mind. Before, and it didn't, by the way, when it was making the amendment that constituted Section 10, it made a few other knick-knacky amendments in the statute, but didn't amend any of the parts of the statute that we're talking about in this case. I see my time's up. May I conclude my remarks?
You may finish your answer briefly.
The legislature did not go back and change any of the other sections that we're talking about here, but they did consciously adopt the Watson approach with this by an insured or beneficiary language. But they didn't do that in the first instance. And so I think that you see that the legislature can respond to the types of problems that we've got, like in this case, but doesn't often do it comprehensively.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court will take another brief recess.
All right.